You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. So pleased you could come and join us tonight to explore the feminine mystique with this distinguished panel. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series and the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. It was, as most of you know, 50 years ago this week that Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique was published. And if there's a list of the most important books of the 20th century, as New York Times columnist Gail Collins notes, Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique is on it. And like all great books of the moment, as Collins observes, it has an eternally quoted lead. And the opening sentence to The Feminine Mystique is, "Gradually, without seeing it clearly for quite a while, I came to realize that something is very wrong with the way American women are trying to live their lives today." That was 1963. And probably like many others, perhaps in this audience who were born in the 50s, I grew up with an ambitious, creative, and frustrated mother who yearned for a more stimulating life of the mind. The Feminine Mystique was one of those books on her nightstand, along with books by Margaret Mead and Sigmund Freud, kind of mixed messages there. 50 years ago, Friedan wrote about a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning among American women who spent their days grocery shopping and doing dishes and chauffeuring their children and asked, "Is this all?" Stephanie Kuntz, a historian of feminism, has written, "Friedan's genius was to provide, with feminine mystique, the first phrase you could use to explain that you thought something was wrong and that it was a lie." Tonight, we've convened a distinguished panel of women who will explore from their different perspectives and experience this landmark of feminist literature and take a look at the gender revolution 50 years on, which is, of course, a really big plan for a 50-minute panel, but we will touch on many things, and we will include you in the discussion. I'm sure it will be very lively. So our guests are Carol Downer, an American feminist lawyer. In 1972, Downer's arrest, trial, and acquittal in a case dubbed the Great Yogurt Conspiracy brought national attention to the Women's Health Education Project that she and her colleagues started, the Feminist Women's Health Centers. She is the co-author of A New View of a Woman's Body and How to Stay Out of the Gynecologist's Office. Tani Ikeda is an award-winning director of narratives, documentaries, music videos, and commercial films. She is also the co-founder of Immediate Justice, a summer workshop and community outreach program for girls devoted to revolutionizing sex education through filmmaking. Hannah Rosen is the author of The End of Men and The Rise of Women, which we also, as I mentioned, have for sale tonight. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic and a founder of Double X Slate's Women's Section, and she's the recipient of a 2010 National Magazine Award. Catherine Spillar is the executive vice president of the Feminist Majority Foundation and the Feminist Majority, national organizations working for women's equality, empowerment, and nonviolence. She's also the executive editor of Ms. Magazine, and we're very pleased to have copies of Ms., complimentary copies, to give to you tonight outside. Spillar is a trained economist and researcher and a specialist in community organizing. And our moderator tonight, who has moderated for us several times before, Dr. Amy Parrish, is a biological anthropologist, primatologist, and Darwinian feminist. She taught at USC in the Gender Studies, Arts and Lectures, Public Health and Anthropology Department for 13 years, and she's conducted groundbreaking research on patterns of female dominance and matriarchal social structure in one of our closest living relatives, the bonobos. And you can hear Amy at Aloud again on April 17th with the famed primatologist Franz de Waal. And she's currently working on a book about love, marriage, and the experience of being a wife. I will turn it over to Amy, and please enjoy the program, and we'll see you out in the lobby afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Louise, and thank you to the library for convening this really important and exciting panel. It's a real honor to be here, and thank you to all of you for joining us tonight. It's a big panel, and it's a big topic, and it's a big book, so we're not aiming to be entirely comprehensive in covering the book, but I thought I would say a few words about the book in case you haven't read it. One of the things that Stephanie Kuntz realized when she decided to write a book about the impact of the feminine mystique was that many people thought they'd read it, but when she actually asked them what was in it, then they realized that they'd never read it, but they'd heard about it and then formed opinions based on that. And it's kind of that way with Darwin as well. A lot of students have never read Darwin, but we're all pretty sure we know what he said. And sometimes you get it right and sometimes you don't. So when Betty Friedan wrote this book, it was actually 50 years ago on Tuesday, she was coming from a somewhat unique position of being both living the subject matter of the book and also being somewhat unique in that she was a journalist, she was a working woman during that time, and so she was calling out an experience that was shared with the women that she wrote about, but also she was a little bit outside of it and had a little bit more privilege than some of the women that she was writing about. But she started out writing for women's magazines and was very constrained in terms of what she was allowed to talk about and what male editors assumed women would want to read about. And as time passed, she decided to go out and investigate what was happening with upper class, mainly white, privileged women who were getting very extensive college educations at prestigious universities and then expected not to use those educations for anything other than becoming the perfect wife and the perfect mother and being consumed with what kind of tarts you make for the bridge game and whether the children's dresses have all the ruffles pressed and that kind of thing. And it's a pretty amazing book, and it's called Revolutionary, and as Louise mentioned, it's often placed on lists of one of the 20th century's most important books, because she really was describing a phenomenon that to that point had not been well delineated. Of course, we had Simone de Beauvoir and other foremothers, but she was describing a particular experience here in America, which I think was made better known by films like The Stepford Wives, that very much that experience of a particular type of woman at a time in America where options were very, very limited. She spent 5 years doing research for the book. It was very, very intense. She went and interviewed people at PR firms, advertising firms, tried to figure out how this message was being sold to women, that their entire identity should not be their own, but only derived from their husbands and their children. There are a lot of criticisms of the book because she looked at this narrow slice of women and then extrapolated from that to all women. And that's really a distinction between different waves of feminism. So the first wave of feminism was Susan B. Anthony and the like, people who were fighting for our right to vote. And then the second wave started with Friedan and then built even more in the 70s. Which really, in this country, focused on giving women equality in the workplace, giving women equality in terms of political power, and we'll be talking tonight about whether the glass is half full or half empty on those accounts. If we were in Europe, there would have been a different strategy, more of a striving for a work-life balance and less about just workplace equality, but more recognition that maybe we needed to acknowledge the challenges that women face in balancing that with desires to have a family. So it's an interesting book. I would say that she laid the groundwork for us to expand in lots of fascinating ways, and probably all of us in this room have a different definition of feminism or different assumptions about what feminism means. And I thought we might start tonight by sharing how we identify as feminists so that you can get an idea of some of the breadth of perspective, and also what brought us to feminism and how that might relate to the discussion of the book. So, Carol, I thought that we might start with you, and I wondered if you could tell us about your identity as a feminist and what it meant to you to read Betty's book.
You know, I reread the book in preparation for this panel. But I read it at the time it was published, within a couple of years. A friend of mine who I had met in night school, finishing my college degree, Laurel Slupsky, said, "You must read this book." And I did. And at the time, it totally resonated with me, and it helped me to organize some of my feelings that I had at that time, because I had fallen prey to this feminine mystique, as just as she had described it, although not on as high a class level as as she did. We couldn't afford to, you know, lead the perfect life in the way that the women in her class could, but that was where, you know, my aspirations were. But it took me, I was calculating, another 7 years, getting divorced, marrying another man, having a couple more children, to finally transition. I mean, I was exploring, being part of the community, working on various issues, to realized that I was indeed a feminist. And, you know, in terms of what kind of feminist, that took me a long time to figure out myself. And, you know, there are many kinds, and all of them have their value. And I don't mean to make any invidious comparisons, but I would call myself a radical feminist, meaning radical, meaning the going to the root. And it means that I came from fighting battles against urban renewal in my neighborhood, being a Girl Scout leader for my daughter at school, being exposed to issues of racism and classism, living through the Watts uprising, then being against the war, along with a lot of other people, and particularly being at the Chicano Moratorium and seeing the sheriffs attack the crowd, all of those kinds of forces interplaying with my own, you know, own desire for justice, but also for my own happiness. And I emerged a radical feminist. So that is sort of...
And we'll go on to hear about some of the very radical things that Carol's done, which are just absolutely amazing. And so maybe, Kathy, I know that you came into feminism a little bit later than Carol, but it definitely relates to that trajectory. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, thanks. And I'm a fan of Carol's and have worked very closely with Carol over many years in this struggle, which is ongoing. I cannot remember a time that I didn't think of myself as a feminist, even from a very early age. I grew up in a household that was very egalitarian. Both of my parents were physicians, and had learned from my mother and my father about the struggles that women were facing. I was born in the mid-50s, so even at the time that this book was coming out, my mother was not living it per se, but confronting the obstacles, and we lived that with her, and I became acutely aware. I can remember as a child understanding how privileged or favored males were, not in our household, but the minute you step out of our household, it was just all too obvious. And I remember fighting for her right among my classmates, that my mother had a job outside the home, and having to explain why she wasn't there for the cupcake days. But feeling, understanding all of that at a very early age. And so as I said earlier when we were talking, in full disclosure, I've never read Betty Friedan's book. I was privileged to meet her on several different occasions, but by time I got active in feminism when the Equal Rights Amendment was not ratified. And so this was 1982. I remember it very well. I came to a big rally downtown Los Angeles, sponsored by the National Organization for Women. These rallies were held all over the country to mark the end of the ratification period. I had no idea why, what process that was, that it wasn't ratified. I could talk to you at length about what the ERA was and why it was important, and I'd never been involved in feminism. Found now at that rally and thought, wow, this is just so terrific. There is an organization that is fighting for women's rights. And I thought at the time that someone like myself had to get involved, that more of us had to get involved in this fight if we were going to reach equality. And so my early reading was very much looking for strategies and answers. How are we going to change the unequal power structure? And learning about the great gains that had been made in the early years of the contemporary movement. And it wasn't just about workplace rights. This movement has delivered more legal changes in education, definitely in employment, in property rights, in credit rights. So much of this that we all take for granted and should take for granted and may not even know that it was a fight. But so much has happened even since the time that I got involved. And the terrific thing about our movement, it's a very large movement. It is so large and so diverse. There are so many organizations working in so many different fields and spheres of our lives. It is impossible really to even define it. Other than feminism very broadly is the belief that women and men are equal, social, in the social world, in the political world, in the economic world, that we should have equality. And the wonderful news about all this is, I can tell you, we've just did a poll of voters in election time, and we've been asking this question now for many years, and fully 55% of all women who were voting, but the numbers hold for the general population too, 55% of women self-identify as feminists without the definition. You give the definition, the numbers go up to around 68%. That's remarkable given the way this word and this movement has been denigrated in the mainstream media and at many different levels of our society. And among men, it is. Let me see, I don't want to misquote this. It's 54% of men identify as feminists. The younger, the higher the identification, the older, the less. But it is a movement that has taken hold in a very big way and is driving our politics. And we can talk more about that later. But it's, don't ever think of yourself as a minority, an unpopular minority. We are the majority and have been for some time. The problem is we don't have the power. So,
thank you, Kathy. Hannah?
Yeah, I totally get that identification question because my experience was completely different, which is I grew up in a working class immigrant neighborhood in which nobody would have ever said they were a feminist. And like in my house, it's absolutely clear that my mother like rules everything. And, you know, I mean, my mother is terrifying at some level. Like she was the neighborhood watchdog. She didn't work for a lot of time, but she could like, she's afraid of nobody and she calls everybody out in the neighborhood. I mean, she's a really like powerful figure. But she never would have said she was a feminist and nor would anyone else. I mean, like we listened to Free to Be You and Me and, you know, we never knew any William who had any doll, but we sang it anyway. And it was like the background of our existence and we learned about it in school. And it's funny because when I wrote this book, many of the women who I write about also would never call themselves feminist. It's like they are in this economic moment where they, for whatever reason, because the men have lost their jobs, and I'm talking about this town in Alabama. I remember talking to the mayor. It's a very religious town, deeply believes that the men are the head of the household. First mayor ever, because they generally don't believe that women belong in positions of leadership. so you're the mayor now. You've been the mayor for 4 years. It's an amazing thing. So, you know, would you say you're a feminist? Oh, my God, no. You know, absolutely not. And it's weird. It's like there's so many ways in which, you know, people sort of the movement helps people or creates space for people, and yet they wouldn't call themselves feminists. And I don't know what to do about that. I mean, Tina Fey has a really funny riff about Sarah Palin, in which she says, you know, okay, feminism's great. Thank you to Sarah Palin for helping my career. And of course, as women, we should all support each other, except that if Sarah Palin, wait, that means that all, except all those people would have to buy their own rape kit. But we love Sarah Palin. Well, except for those of us who believe in evolution, forget it, we hate Sarah Palin. You know, it's like this confusing thing of like, there's this movement and it helps all women, but then some of them, you know, are not, wouldn't call themselves feminists, even though they would check. I mean, Sarah Palin would say, yes, women should be able to run for office, hold positions of leadership, be eligible for blah, 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 be the governor. I'm not a feminist, you know? So what do you do with those, basically?
And then, right. I think that's definitely kind of an interesting entry point for me. I'd say that my status relationship with feminism would be, it's complicated. And I say that because I identify as a queer woman of color, and I feel like in a lot of those circles, the feminist movement didn't take into consideration a lot of their concerns, especially for some of the queer folks who are gender nonconforming. A question is, what does it mean to work under the banner of gender, of a gender term, while you're challenging and questioning socially constructed gender altogether? Or, you know, why are we still trying to prove that this term can and does encompass more than the narrow communities and agendas it's often associated with? So these are some of the questions that have come up in conversation. But, you know, despite those qualms, I've still found that feminism offers the best model I know for looking at challenging systems of oppression in an interconnected way. I mean, if you think about Audre Lorde, the Combahee River Collective, bell hooks, you know, all of these people insisted on a complex, you know, refusal to separate the intimate from the public, the political from the personal. You know, and I think that that's really how I start to engage in politics. It's coming from a very personal place. And then the other thing of what feminism means to me is, I would call it the feminist process. You know, because when you do community organizing and it's for this beautiful dream of social justice, a lot of times you are so broke, burnt out, tired, that's very hard to sustain that kind of work. So, you know, we talk about the feminist process really being something where we're taking care of ourselves and each other. You know, if somebody gets triggered in the work, how do we create space to really heal around that and talk about it?
I think that the feminist movement has matured extraordinarily over this last 50-year period. And it's out of women's studies, the whole idea of intersectionality, that you, once you become a critical thinker on gender, then you begin to connect that with race and class and orientation or identity. I mean, it is more complex. It is a wonderful field of discipline to study, to really understand the world and to be a critical thinker and to I mean, there's all kinds of research that's showing that women's studies graduates are highly desirable because of their ability to handle and understand complex systems and situations. And I think that I know that within now, you know, taking a position on gay and lesbian and bisexual rights was one of the earliest, if not the earliest, organization to do that, and certainly has dealt with these struggles throughout, but I think that we're in a very good place, and the movement is very diverse and very large, and I think it's a good movement for reaching where we all want to be.
So what we're really tracing here is sort of a history from the second wave into the third wave of feminism, which was that recognition that Betty Friedan didn't really capture the experience of all women, and that it was impossible to understand the oppression of women if you didn't also understand the oppression of race and class, and recognize where you have privilege and where you don't. And I kind of straddle those waves myself because I was raised by a radical feminist mother, and we also grew up with Free to Be You and Me, and I actually knew Williams with Dolls, and you know, we protested against grapes and tomatoes, and we marched for the ERA, and when I came home with an assignment in second grade to write a little essay on what you want to be, and I thought I might write about being a nurse, my mother said, why don't you consider being an anesthesiologist? They make a lot more money, and it shouldn't just be men who have those jobs. And so I grew up with that that idea that, you know, girls are as good as boys, and they can do anything. And then I went into academia, which is just the bastion of sexism. It is so entrenched, and it just, I mean, I really have to say the glass is half empty there. It's just absolutely unbelievable. So one of the anecdotes I was telling over dinner was of this experience being in a gender studies department at one of the universities where I've worked, and a woman had to leave the meeting early to go and get her kindergartner, pick them up. And the chair of the department, who was a woman, said, I don't see why that's a valid reason to get to leave the meeting. I mean, I want to go to the library. And I thought, if the chair of gender studies doesn't understand that this is not a perk to leave the meeting, but it's a challenge because you have these multiple responsibilities, then what hope do we have? And it was this real kind of eye-opening experience of, wow, yeah, we've been raised with not just the rhetoric, but the hope and the promise. And I think we're partway there, but maybe not quite as far as I had hoped that we would be in the 21st century. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about comparing where we were versus where we are now. And maybe, Carol, could we start with you? And, you know, where do you see the glass half full and versus half empty?
Well, I'll agree with Kathy, that much of the movement has become much more sophisticated. I think we've got a long way to go. I really do. And I think it's very difficult to deal with all of these contradictions amongst ourselves. It's a struggle. It's not easy. I think I would say that most women have a very that are in the women's movement have a good will to try, and we sometimes succeed and sometimes we don't. I agree with Connie that this is it is the bottom line, because let me just throw in one of my own little personal things I want to talk about tonight, and it illustrates what we're talking about, I think. And this is the Hyde Amendment. A few years after Roe v. Wade was passed, Henry Hyde came up with a brilliant idea of attaching a rider to the budget bill that would prevent the federal government from giving any federal monies for women to help them to get abortions, women that could not afford it. And it was a brilliant tactic, because obviously he had the pro-choice people, you know, strapped there because they wanted to see that budget passed. And it passed. Well, in California, and I will bring this to myself, and my group, we had an abortion clinic here in Los Angeles. It was the first legal abortion clinic in California, 50 days after Roe v. Wade. And when the Hyde Amendment was passed, we were outraged. But since California continued to fund Medi-Cal, you know, with Medi-Cal for abortions, and since our other feminist clinics around the country put their efforts into raising funds to help the women who couldn't afford it, we did not, you know, linger over that fight. And that was a very serious error in retrospect, because, you know, the whole principle of politics is divide and conquer. Well, Hyde did a brilliant thing. He split the feminists who could afford abortions from those who could not. And it was, it really, we've suffered over the years, and that was a mistake. It just, you know, right now, for example, we have organizations in Washington who advocate for abortion rights. And now, of course, is a feminist organization. The others are not. They have other motives for supporting this. Even though they're on our side, they have a different political agenda. At any rate, they have not fought this battle. You know, every year it has to be repassed. The Hyde Amendment is sunsets every year. And I think that my own feeling is that until we as a women's movement recognize that we've got to get rid of that Hyde Amendment and make that a priority, we're not going to get all women behind this, because we're not representing all of them, at least not in that very vital situation.
That's a great example, Carol. Thank you. That's Kathy, would you like to add to that or take it in another direction in terms of where we were and where we are now?
We're a long way from where we started, that's for sure. I'm not sure if it's half empty or half full, because we're so far still from full equality. And the fight is very much alive. And the whole struggle over reproductive rights and the ability of women to control their own fertility and their reproductive lives is so central to the struggle, because without the ability to control when and if or ever you have children, or what you can do about an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy, you have no control. Here we are, 40 years after Roe versus Wade, and we are still fighting a backlash to this very fundamental right. And now we're even fighting over access to birth control, how we're, you know. So I mean, it's a struggle that continues. And when you understand how central that is to women's full equality, you understand why the backlash is so severe. And you know, there would not be a backlash if there had not been significant forward movement. In a way, you can take heart that the fight is so terrible right now, because we have made so much progress. And one of the things that we've always avoided doing is calling this issue a choice issue, because it is not a choice that can be exercised if you don't have the economic resources. But it also implies that women here or all over the world, you know, have a choice, and that's what they're dealing with. They're dealing with survival. They're dealing with their lives. They're dealing with the ability to take care of the families or children they have, and to have a healthy life themselves. And to this very day, women are dying from illegal abortions around the world, much of it because of U.S. policy. The Hyde Amendment was extended. In fact, it's even worse in terms of international aid. So thinking about ourselves as part of a worldwide movement, and this movement is worldwide. It's not a Western idea. It wasn't exported from the U.S. In fact, the movement in South Asia is much older than the movement in the U.S. So we are much of a global movement, and these new communication technologies have all made it very possible for this movement to come together. And I think it's a very exciting time in many ways, even though we're continuing to fight this rear guard action. We should take heart, because this is an exciting period, and we can make much, much more progress in the next few years.
And Hannah, I'm thinking about your book, and it makes me think about Lionel Tiger, who's an anthropologist at Rutgers, who wrote a book called The Decline of Males, maybe about 12 years ago, and your book is The End of Men, so maybe he was predicting what you're now describing. But I remember him attributing the decline of males to the advent of birth control. And so, what we're talking about...
Wait, meaning this, what? You have to draw a few dots there for me.
The advent of birth control gave women, it empowered women in ways that they never had power before. And it was sort of the beginning of the end of men, in a sense, that then men no longer could dictate
the
parameters to women in the way they could in the past. And so I wonder, in thinking about your book, you're describing...
Well, Stephanie Kuntz and I had this conversation. There's a sense in which, there's lots of different things going on, right? So there's some ways in which, things are the same as they ever were, and there are some ways in which things are completely upside down, and Betty Friedan could not have imagined it, and nor could any of her critics or readers. And one thing is that... we're in a moment of masculine mystique. This is actually Stephanie's phrase, but what do I mean by that? I mean that if you think of feminine mystique as meaning that we defined what it means to be a woman in an unnecessarily narrow way that completely imprisoned women in 1963, there is a way in which now we have defined masculinity in an unnecessarily narrow way, which is imprisoning certain men and preventing them from getting the education they need because that's unmanly, or doing certain jobs. Like, this town that I report on in the book, the jobs that are available when a big manufacturer leaves in a middle-sized town or a small town are in the hospital or in the government or teaching. All perfectly good jobs, but so I asked the guy, you're like a really smart guy, why don't you be a teacher? Like, why don't you go work at the hospital? Women's jobs, So there's a way in which, you define manliness in a narrow way. I mean, I have to admit that after talking about this book, I've stopped thinking of feminism as something for women only. Like, I've started to have this concept that, if you think about maternity leave, something we're hilariously behind on, right? Barbarically behind. We're the only country that doesn't have paid maternity leave. There's three countries in the world and we're one of them. Woohoo! That's a great universe to be in. So if you think about that, I almost wish we would skip over the maternity leave conversation and just talk about childcare or family leave, or get to where Sweden is, skip over the rest of Europe and go straight to Sweden. Because I think, if we start to include men in the idea of domesticity, right? If you start to immediately say, men take care of kids too, take this out of purely the women realm and put it in the family realm, you could sort of skip ahead a decade and make yourself really progressive. Another definition I often think of is, let's say you had a world in which people paid less of a penalty for choosing across traditional gender ground. So you take someone like Marissa Mayer, who, got the job as CEO of Yahoo, and she was pregnant and she said she wasn't going to take any maternity leave. People were horrified by that, right? That caused a huge debate. Now, in my mind, is she a role model for me? No, I really like my maternity leave. I was happy with all of them, But there should be a space for a woman like that who wants to do that, and we don't need to judge her to death for that, just like there should be a space for a guy who chooses to be a guy in a different way than men have been men, whether it's work less or, take care of his kids or, be gay or whatever. That space, it's about opening up spaces in both directions.
And that, that really complements Susan Faludi's ideas in her book Stiffed, which was that her basic thesis was that patriarchy doesn't just oppress women, it oppresses almost all men too. So most men are oppressed in order to benefit very few sort of alpha males at the top. And it's kind of was echoed in the Romney campaign, I would say, in the last election. It's my personal viewpoint.
That book was the end. I wrote this book because I read her book.
Because
I read her book and thought, okay, if this was what was happening in the 1990s, now we are a few recessions later, what's happening now?
Yeah.
So that was where I started the inquiry is after reading her book, so...
Well, Tani, I wanted to ask you. You said that a few years ago, you would never have imagined considering being on a panel about the feminine mystique, or you never would have imagined that you would have had something positive to say. So I'm wondering, what were you thinking then, and what are you thinking now?
Well, first, I just want to acknowledge it's really exciting for me to be on this panel. I don't oftentimes get a chance to have such an intergenerational conversation about this material. I guess in reading Betty Friedan's Feminist Mystique, I read it more as a historical document because I felt like so much of it, it was hard for me to relate to in some ways.
You don't worry about slip covers?
Slip covers, no. No, not high on my
priority. I know what a slip cover was when I reread this. I was like, is it the same as a pillowcase or is it different than a pillowcase?
But when I think about, you know, who she must have been at that particular time when, you know, this was a problem with no name and she was trying to define it and she was going to the homes of different women and hearing their stories and hearing how much they blamed themselves for not being enough, that's something that I related to. Because I feel like, again, as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, as somebody who's working with young women so that they can tell their own stories through film, again, it's about, you know, through our stories, how can we pinpoint the invisibilities and the things that have no name? And I guess what's also interesting is I feel like I grew up in a generation of women who were saturated in this commercialized market of girls' empowerment. You know, there's Powerpuff Girls, there's Destiny's Child singing I'm a Survivor, and we're being told you can be anything you want to be, even the president. You know, so we're kind of all amped up on these steroids thinking I can conquer the world, and 10 years later when we're pursuing our careers, again, coming up against the same glass ceiling, I think that's what propels a lot of young women to engage in feminism and activism. But, you know, for a lot of women, it's almost a similar question that Betty Friedan had to tackle with, which is, you know, going back inward and saying, well, if I have all my rights already, you know, why am I not succeeding in the way that I thought I would? Why have I not achieved my dreams? So that's something.
That's an interesting thing after Betty Friedan, because she had this idea, like, you just go to work. You know, just a work, it'll be fine. Just get out of your house and go to work, you know? And I think that's one thing to think about now. It's like, okay, a lot of women work, right? Women are more than half of the workforce. At least they were when I started this book. Now they're about half. And it didn't solve all the problems. So it just, like, created a whole new set of problems.
But feminism never said that would, I mean, maybe Friedan said that. But the feminist movement has been much more sophisticated and holistic in its approach. And it has been about changing fundamentally the balance of power and the way our institutions are structured. And we don't have all the rights. And what has failed to change more is the institutions. And how this is the hardest part, because this is where the power lies. And we have studied feminist movements all over the world extensively, and everybody looks at Western Europe and thinks that that's the best. But I can tell you, when you sit down and talk with them, they have really taken a very strategic approach to power. And they were the first to promote the idea of gender balance laws in elections and mandating positive quotas. In this country, quotas has a very negative connotation because they've been used to keep people out. They turn that word around, and they talk about positive quotas. But they said, you know, because this is over this 25-year period, they said, we do have more political power because we made the rules that we had to have shared power. But beware, because the minute those doors open, other doors, the power moves, and you've got to constantly be looking at where the power really resides. And everything they said has absolutely come true. They felt they didn't have the economic power, and pretty soon they began pushing for gender balance rules in corporate boards. So you can't be located or do business in Sweden or Norway unless your corporate board has more gender balance. But then the rules begin to change, and the presidents and the prime ministers begin to implement rules where now that they had 40% of the parliament, they wanted to implement extra committees that were super parliament committees. So they were composed partially of those in the parliament, but then you added on business leaders, and all the business leaders were men. And so I think it's a good... I think it's something we've got to focus on, is how do we rebalance, or for the first time in history, balance the power. That's what we're trying to... I think it's one of the biggest challenges this movement now faces here and all over the world, is how to get more balance in power, because women and men still live very segregated lives. We live a very gender-segregated existence, even to this day. And so we bring different perspectives on every problem you can name. And it's the lack of this balance in so many ways that's causing so many problems.
Well, I think we're having a kind of a little neglect here, in the sense that, yes, Fredan came from the vantage point of how you shouldn't get women educated and then make them be housewives. But that's not all she says. And her book also, she goes into proposals as to what needs to be done. And very key amongst that, besides having something similar to a veterans bill for women to be able to, you know, go back to school, et cetera, which I think is a very sound idea, but also she very specifically talks about women's sexuality and control of our own body. That's, you know, she doesn't give it a whole book because that wasn't her focus. But she definitely did. And also, the women's movement, as we're discussing it here, one of its, I would have to say, one of its strongest components is the women's health movement.
And I noticed, Carol, you have a speculum there on the table, and she never goes anywhere without it. It's got its own little container. So maybe you'd like to say a little bit about how you addressed the really entrenched sexism in medicine.
Well, you know, we came together in the early 70s, and this was as the reform movement to get abortion legalized was coming up in the country. I mean, this predates the women's movement. We came in force behind an already established momentum toward getting abortion laws changed. But we came into it in a slightly different way, and that is that we didn't just want to make abortion legal. We wanted to learn how to do it. We wanted to take that power out of the existing male structure. NARAL was originally called the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws. It later got changed to a much more modest kind of goal. But, you know, women were realized that we could not remain ignorant about our bodies. And women's clinics started, and women's night at free clinics started up, and women started having, like, the Berkeley Health Collective learning these skills. And in Los Angeles, we found that by using... We started to learn how to do abortions ourselves at a clinic over in West Los Angeles.
This was pre-Roe v.
Clinic.
Wade, Pre-Roe v. Wade?
California had passed the Therapeutic Abortion Act, but the abortionist was not a doctor, and it was not in a hospital, so it was quite illegal. And we started observing, and it was apparent that, you know, this was a very safe and simple procedure, and the fact that 5,000 women a year in the United States alone were dying from illegal abortions was just outrageous. And so we started using this disposable speculum, which they used in clinics to throw away, but by inserting it. The doctor uses it this way. Someone said, ow?
Yes.
Well, there you go. That pretty much sums up what our experience with speculums had been in the hands of, you know, the medical profession, which at that time was 99% male. We found that, in fact, it was not painful, very simple to do. We could visualize our own cervix. Could tell where we were in our menstrual period, menstrual cycle. We could spot early pregnancy. We could extract our periods. We could extract an early pregnancy. We did this in groups. This was not a individualistic going home and, you know, becoming junior doctors at home. This was women meeting together, seeing each other's cervixes, sharing information. We started from the ground up. For example, we found that many of us had been told that we had tipped uteruses. And this explained everything, you know. And lo and behold, when we actually started looking at each other, all of us, not all of us, but 90% of us had our uterus, which, by the way, is a floating organ and could assume different positions at different times, that varied from the textbook angle that it was at. And it explained nothing. You know, we found that we didn't need to put dangerous drugs into our body to deal with simple yeast conditions, ways to solve menstrual cramps, on and on and on. And, you know, oh, and of course, I got to say the biggest thing is, and this was after we had been going a few years and were writing our book, we wanted a section on, you know, our reproductive and sexual organs. And we assigned Lorraine Rothman to do that because we had a book committee. And most of us were, you know, progressing, but she wasn't. And she said, I don't know what to do with this. She said, there's all these nerves and muscles and blood. I can't make head nor tails of it. Well, turns out that, you know, this so-called clitoris that's a pea-sized bump, you know, that's supposed to be the center of all sexual pleasure, is just the tip of the iceberg, literally. That, in fact, we have a sexual organ very similar to the penis in the sense of the different types of tissues, very similar in the stages of the sexual response, and very, you know, achievable by any woman, not this mysterious will-o'-the-wisp thing. And, you know, that is the full clitoris. Well, Right. This is just... This was just within a year or two of women actually looking at each other.
Mm-hmm. I want to express my personal gratitude to you for that, for those discoveries. No, seriously, I remember I got out of the library once, the 1972, the early version of Our Bodies Ourselves, and decided it was my favorite book ever. It's like the grooviest, everyone looking around, everyone's hairy, nobody's shaved, nobody looks perfect. It was awesome. You have to think, like, if you think about Lena Dunham, like, maybe there's some, you know, it's like, just be naked. Like, there's some, you know, there's some continuous message there.
And you don't get it in Glamour magazine or, yeah.
And we use this book at Immediate Justice to teach the youth. Yeah, we use your book.
So we're talking about A New View of Women's Bodies, which you can still get on Amazon and various other places. And it really has beautiful illustrations of all of the clitoral sponge tissue and the different stages that Carol and her group identified of female sexual arousal. And it really did radically change how we look at women's bodies and whether women can be in charge of their own bodies. And I recently went to a play reading of a play about Henrietta Lacks, and the audience was giving feedback to the playwright afterwards. And there were a lot of donors there, so older, very privileged people, and they were all questioning the premise that there's any racism or sexism in medicine. So I started getting my cortisol level kind of went through the roof. So I had to raise my hand and talk about, you know, how widespread it is. And then I asked, you know, how many of you have had an experience in your doctor's office where you've experienced some form of racism or sexism or both or classism? And pretty much everybody under 50 raised their hand, men and women. Mm. And so I think you really did help change that landscape of at least starting to realize that there is that power differential there. And I mean, the first mark of privilege, my friend Moshe Rosdahl likes to say, is not recognizing that you have it, right? And I think that's a really good thing to keep in mind. And there are lots of websites now where you can go on and find out what kind of privilege you have. And there's also a book, Kate Bornstein's book, My Gender Workbook. You can figure out how much privilege. And the first question is, do you have a penis? And if you say yes, you get 250 points right there. This says that pretty much wins the game. It's really an interesting experience.
Right. Well, even in the illustrations, I mean, they're illustrated off of, you know, real women.
Yes.
So there's a variety of different images that you wouldn't see in a normal book. And then we're also able to make our curriculum trans-friendly. Like you said, your clit could be your dick. Some of the words, you know, can be interchangeable in a lot of ways.
Right.
So I think the work is still very radical, and we're taught to relinquish our bodies to our doctors and not know anything about it. So, you know, I have my own speculum, and the first time I used it, I had so much anxiety. You know, I asked people, am I doing it right? You know, I don't know what things look like down there or what it's supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I couldn't find my ass, and I was just, you know,
really. it's really
you know, it's not something we're acquainted with, really.
Hannah, I'm thinking about your book, and one part that really fascinated me was your discussion of hookup culture, because usually that's described in really pejorative terms that, oh, poor women, they're subjected to this hookup culture, and really, of course, they would want to be in relationships with men that are more sustained or more defined, and the way that you presented it was really that this is a choice that young women are making that fits their career trajectories that maybe men don't have.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's so conscious. I think it just ends up that way. Like, there are many arguments I've had with women about my book, but I have to say, in that one chapter is the chapter which I have gotten, I wish I had my letters with me that I got from young women. That's the chapter I've gotten the most gratitude about, like, you know, just reframing that a little bit so we don't only think of, like, young sexual culture as made by men, for men, in which women are entirely the victims, because there's a way in which, especially at that age, they're kind of masters of their own destiny in a way that they have never been historically. So you have these, it's not that you wouldn't go on an average college campus and talk to lots of women and they wouldn't have a lot of complaints, because they would have a lot of complaints about, you know, whatever, the men won't commit, or the, you know, whatever complaints they have of the men are rude, or the men don't want to get in relationships, they don't treat you with respect, you know, all that comes out. On the other hand, it's not like as it might have been in Betty Friedan's day, your whole aim is, like, your whole destiny is not riding on the way a man treats you. It's like, you know, that could be one sort of small part of your experience, but you're really thinking about your internship, your life, your identity, how you want to set yourself up. So it doesn't loom as large for women. They're not, like, destroyed by what happens to them at that age, I think. So it was just, it was slightly more empowering way of seeing what goes on.
Oh, it's fascinating. Well, I mean, we want to leave time to hear from all of you, and I feel like this is the time to transition into that. There are people who are going to circulate with microphones because we are recording for podcasts. We'd ask you if you could to please actually ask a question, and we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say. Okay.
Hi, this is a little bit of a Betty Friedan anecdote with a question on the end. 50 years ago, when she was doing her book tour, she landed in our small college town of Pullman, Washington, where my dad was campus minister and community organizer. And he went to see her, and he thought she was fantastic. And he was so enthusiastic that he ran up afterwards and said, "Oh, you were so great, Betty. You know, gee, I wish Marge could be here." And he said, and she said, "George, where's Marge?" "Oh, she's home with the kids."
Oh, God.
So my mom told me that story when I was a teenager, and I'm just wondering how that would play out today? What would be the likelihood of that scenario? And what would be the response?
That's a really good question. I mean, you know, we're still working on the question of, like, whose realm is domesticity? So I didn't end up writing this in the book, but I did a huge research, just a big study about what we call breadwinner wives, so women who make more money than the men they're with, their partners, boyfriends, husbands, and then I interviewed a lot of, many thousands of people answered the survey, and then I interviewed lots of them, and there would be cases in which the woman made vastly more money, I remember this one woman I interviewed as like a multi-million-dollar real estate lawyer, and yet she still would not give up the domestic realm, like she still considered it her space. There was lots of explanations in the different couples I talked to. It's like either because the husband didn't want to, or because the wife felt that it was wrong not to, or it was a way for her to express her femininity because she felt like she was working too much. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons that women give for this, but you can still imagine lots of situations where, the man would be out and the woman would still be home. It's just kind of complicated why that happens, you know?
Let's take another question.
Hi there.
Excuse me, Amy. Could we repeat the questions?
Sure. Okay, so after you ask it, I'll repeat.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure.
I have a question in terms of, this is relating to the Lilly Ledbetter Law. Mm. In this, you know, of course, in our savage capitalistic society, it's pretty difficult, if not impossible, to find out what your coworkers are making. Now, as we all know, women don't get paid the same thing for doing the same job, which to me is so fundamentally evil. I'm just speechless. But since that you can't really find out from coworkers what they make, and you know for a fact that men are making more money than women in every level, professional, you know, just to blue collar, whatever. And the poor women at Walmart, they get hired. They're shown how to get food stamps when they're having a full time job. What possibly can be done in this situation when you're really prohibited to find out what your coworkers are making? And I find it just very distressing. So,
Could you hear that, Carol?
No,
okay.
Not at all.
Okay. So the question was about, even though we have the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act now, it's still almost impossible to find out what your coworkers make. And so how can we ever remedy the situation of women so systemically being underpaid? Kathy?
We need the Paycheck Fairness Act, which has been stalled in Congress for 3 years, which would protect workers who do talk to other co-workers about what they make. The Lilly Ledbetter Act just got us back to where we were before the Supreme Court dug into Title VII around sex discrimination, which also had implications for age discrimination and disability. So it only got us back to where we were. And we need other new ideas and new strategies. It's very expensive to take a lawsuit. We just lost, you know, the big Walmart case. Too big to be sued, it turns out. You can be too big to be sued. You can't have a big enough class action to really have an impact on an employer of that size. And so it's left for individual women to take these cases. We need tougher enforcement from the Department of Justice and the EEOC. We need more lawsuits, but they're very expensive. We need pay equity laws, not just equal pay for equal work, because one of the major reasons women earn less than men overall is we have a gender segregated workforce. Women are still very heavily segregated into just certain areas, which, guess what, they pay less. We need pay equity or comparable worth laws that look at different kinds of jobs and compare those jobs so that you can say a female-dominated job and a male-dominated job are really comparable and look at the pay structure there. It was a big movement in the 80s and the 90s to get those laws passed, and it stalled. It stalled because we could never get a decent hearing in Congress, of course. But some states have passed these comparable worth laws, and it is making a difference in those states.
Thanks, Kathy.
I am a senior in high school. It's a very progressive high school. We have clubs for every religion, every ethnicity, every sexual orientation. And there's no such thing as gender inequality among students. You know, all of our girl sports teams always go farther than the boys sports teams. It's every year it's the same thing. We have so many girls who are way better at science and math and all those things than the boys are. And yet feminism is still a dirty word. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how, as one person, it's really frustrating, actually, when you say, when people don't understand that being a feminist is not a bad thing. How do you convince people, as one person, even as a couple people, how do you convince students who are young, who should be much more open to things like this, how do you convince them that it's in fact not a dirty word and that it's a good thing?
I mean, I have a very strong opinion on this, so I'll answer if no one else is. I was pausing. The question is, in her high school, she's saying among young people, feminism is a dirty word. And what do you do about that? You run a campaign, Sarika. She's one of our Girls Learn International student activists. On this is what a feminist looks like. And you get people to wear the T-shirt or to some colleges and universities through our college program. They'll take pictures of everybody and they have a big wall. This is what a feminist looks like. Or ask me what a feminist is. It's a word that has been so attacked for so long. And it's been attacked because you really can't in polite company say women should not have equal rights. I mean, that really is not acceptable. It used to be.
Oh, I get it all the time still. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's the last acceptable ism.
I haven't heard that that plain, but what they always say is, they talk about feminists. You know, if you can't attack the message, you attack the messenger. And it's an effort to get everybody to say, well, I'm not a feminist, but. And as I said earlier, I mean, the remarkable thing is, even in that climate, when you do public opinion polling, yeah, it's different when you're asking an individual, do you consider yourself a feminist? Or in a classroom, everybody's sort of looking around, should I say I'm a feminist or not? But in public opinion polling, where there is this sense that you're not going to be judged, people say what they believe much more likely. It also makes a difference, by the way, whether it's a female interviewer on the telephone or a male interviewer on the telephone, and whether they're interviewing a male or a female. And we actually measure for that in our polling, because we want to know if a female's asking a female or if a male's asking a female, is there a difference? There is a difference. The woman who will never meet this man who's made the phone call to do the survey is more reluctant to say she's a feminist because she's afraid of being judged. And it's interesting, men answering a female caller on the survey are more likely to say they are a feminist because they think that's what she wants to hear, even though this is a public opinion poll. But I guess my point is, you know, you got to sort of challenge that. Give people a comfort zone to come forward and say, I didn't know you were a feminist. I am too. It is actually a very popular thing to be. And it has a wonderful history, as you know.
Wear it with pride.
I also think it's I was just going to say, I also think it's a question of taking up space and making feminism cool. So I'm a music video director, and I deal with hip-hop and rap artists who sometimes want to pour champagne on women. And, you know, when I'm approaching this, I'm not going to say, well, that's not a very feminist idea. I just say, well, that's not really popular anymore. It's not in trend. It's very 90s. You know, so there are different ways you can enter into the conversation and make it a very relevant thing that people need to pay attention to.
And Carol, did you have something to add as well?
Well, I certainly agree with everything that's been said, but I have myself a little bit different approach to this, in that changing society and ideas is just never going to be a way to, you know, become class president. I mean, it. I think really, if what we're about is to bring about social change, that doesn't necessarily mean numbers. It doesn't necessarily mean that you can go out and, I mean, it's interesting to hear these
statistics from the polls, but you know, if nobody else in this country was a feminist, I would still be a feminist. And and I think that that is what ultimately is a stronger base to build from. Find those, you know, exemplify what you want, fight for what you think is right, align with people who agree with that, and you know that. I believe is ultimately a stronger position.
And I would add, Carol was often the only person standing out on a street corner in LA protesting the Iraq War. So you really are a role model for all of us in your integrity and your commitment to the cause. And I've learned so much from you. Thank you. We have time for maybe one more question or maybe two, depending. Two? Okay.
Hi. I'm trying to think how to exactly frame this question, but I was reading something recently saying how, talking about teaching literature and reading, especially in the younger grades, and how girls are totally okay with reading boy stories, you know, the boy is a protagonist and the hero and the adventures, but boys are very reluctant and they do not want to, you know, read the girls' stories, and they don't want to see chick flicks and things. And it just makes you wonder, what is it? Is it something innate in boys that they don't want to be associated with the feminine? Or even at that young age, are they so socialized to stay away from the girly side because they're going to be teased for it? And I don't even exactly know what my question is, but why do you think that is, that boys are so against being girly while girls are okay with being boyish?
I've thought about this a lot, and it's actually, it goes on into adulthood. Like, there are these personality tests that have been done since the 60s in which you get to choose a series of traits that define yourself, like nurturing or aggressive or dominant. And, you know, we all think of these as traditionally feminine or traditionally masculine. And since the 60s, girls have started to self-define across the spectrum. So they hung on to the girl, you know, the traditionally feminine terms like nurturing and empathetic, and they adopted all the masculine terms that only men used to use in the 60s, like aggressive, you know, dominant, whatever. And the men have done the opposite since the 60s, which is back away from terms that are feminine and kind of back more into a masculine corner. And, you know, it's the same, like I was talking about that guy who said he would never be a teacher. Like, this is a kind of thing that I think haunts men for a long time. And I don't know if it's, I don't know, and I don't know that any of us will ever know if it's biological or cultural. It's probably some combination of those two things. But I do think it's become pretty crippling.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's a question of the gender binary not providing room for anyone to truly be themselves. I mean, you've got these unrealistic, you know, ideas of what a man and a woman should be, which means that a lot of young men are cut off from their hearts, can't express their emotions or vulnerability.
And I agree totally. And it just shows you how pervasive the messages are. I mean, even if you're trying to raise children in a, you know, non-restrictive or egalitarian, it's just so pervasive. Look at the toy stores. Look at the color schemes. It Video takes games. Them 3 seconds as part of a group with other children to pick up on these messages, even if your household isn't giving those messages. It's just, it's so pervasive and starts so early.
Quick thing, at the very end of my book, I write about one of my favorite studies ever, which was done on these two oil rigs, where they decided that the reason that there were so many safety accidents, which there were a huge number of safety accidents, is because the men would never ask for help, and they would never, like, describe what their mood was, or if they were really upset about something, like they were getting a divorce, they wouldn't talk about it, and then they'd be distracted. And so they implemented basically, like, you know, feminism 101, and they had them on the oil rigs kind of isolated from their families. So they called it the safety program, but it was actually, they'd have these kind of est meetings in the morning where everyone was supposed to say what they were feeling that day and what was hard for them the day before, and it totally worked. Like, you wouldn't believe the quotes that these men were saying at the end of the program. It's actually a really funny study to read, but it just shows you, like, you take this sort of isolated sample and you can just, like, you can turn it if you work really hard at it pretty quickly.
And I would just add, I raised my son in a rainforest in Thailand while I was studying white-handed gibbons, and so he was very removed removed from commercialism. And, you know, when somebody would ask him, what do you want for Christmas? He would say, new black socks. And everybody kind of look at him. And so, I mean, there are ways. It's a little bit extreme, but there are ways to remove some of that cultural influence. So, yeah. All right, last question.
This is sort of a complicated question. I wanted to know about your vision for the care and raising of children, because child care out of pocket is really expensive, especially for middle-class families. And the libraries are now where children go after school until their parents pick them up. And when the libraries had reduced hours, it was a disaster for so many middle-class families. So I wanted to know about your vision.
Oh, yes, I'll repeat the question. So the question was, with the increasing challenges of childcare and the cutbacks in terms of library services, what do we envision in terms of creating a situation that will work for rearing our children? I guess maybe kind of in the it takes a village model, which I totally ascribe to. And it's a great chance to say support your library, and you can become a donor today. So I'll start with that. Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
Oh, I find childcare a disaster in this country. It's such a bad issue. I mean, I was recently looking back in the Nixon administration. That was the last time they had kind of a culture war over childcare. You know, and it was a serious culture war. I mean, a serious culture war. Like, this is the country we live in. Like, people think that's a loaded issue in this country, the idea that government is going to somehow take care of your children or tell you what to do with your children. I think now we talk about it in terms of preschool. Maybe that would be the clever Democratic strategy, is to keep calling it preschool, but, like, extended to age one, so we would never call it childcare, because preschool is kind of a neutral term, but childcare is a really loaded term, because that's something mothers should be doing, you know? So I don't know. I just thought of that. We'll try and sell that one.
Well, I'd just like to share a thought that occurred to me just in this very discussion here, and that is that if it is so that women are surviving this economic decline of our country that has been going on for, 30 years at least, and they are gaining some goals, then why is it they aren't demanding this child care? You see, I don't think they are being liberated. I think they're being... yes, they get little perks. They're not quite as... You know, I'm not saying it's all bad, but in fact, if it was really empowering women, then we would see a groundswell of demand. But no, we're not. Women are just somehow trying to figure out how to... I mean, I just... A young woman that is a friend of mine is in a dilemma because her mother takes care of her son, and she's just recently separated from the father. And it's being very hard on her mom, and her mom is making it kind of hard on her, too. She's kind of guilt-tripping her about why did you marry this guy, and et cetera, you know. Mm-hmm. And she went to see what it would cost to get child care for her son, her year-old son, and it was $300 a week. She can't do that. And even though she makes a good salary, she's got a good job. Nevertheless, it was, you know, and so we just had to start off with the premise of, you know, how she could solve her immediate problem. But where feminism comes in is that each woman doesn't have to solve their problem as an individual. We get together and say, hey, this affects all of us and our children, and let's work together and solve it.
So one of the things I was hoping would happen with this panel is that we could offer some calls to action that you could all take home with you. And I think you've heard a number of those tonight. We can all fight for the Paycheck Fairness Act. We can work against the re-upping of the Hyde Amendment. We can fight for better child care.
Were there others?
Those are the three make demands in our own lives of partners and the community about right. treatment, about responsibility, about power shifts. Very, very critical. But it's the personal as well as the political. It's both.
Absolutely.
It's a very big, radical movement.
Thank you to all of you.
To comment on what you said also, I think motherhood's very stigmatized. So if there's ways to be better allies for mothers and create spaces that foster childcare, instead of looking at the woman in the back of the room and saying, why is her baby crying? She's disturbing my, you know, conference, you know, to really foster more of those conversations would be important.
Thank you for saying that, Tani. That's very, very important. And thank you to all of you for being here tonight.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.